Welcome to the Boots on the Ground podcast, presented by The Mission Continues.
I was born and raised in Arizona, grew up mainly in a small town called Superior. Growing up, I didn't really appreciate it until like I left and didn't have it anymore. Because you know, when it's there every day and it's just kind of, you know, commonplace, it doesn't seem that extraordinary. Growing up, I had some really powerful memories around my uncle serving. Well, that generation of my family serving in Vietnam, it was typically, you know, hearing the story secondhand from someone who, you know, they had opened up to, and then, you know, hearing little bits and pieces about their service, but also about, you know, how they were treated when they came home and the whole transition from, you know, military life to civilian life then, and some of the aspects of how difficult that was in a really tumultuous time in American history. But just hearing the reverence and the respect that was given to them, like, you know, it's powerful, especially for a young man. Since I was a little boy, you know, G.I. Joes were my thing. Like, you know, I had a very eclectic collection of action figures of G.I. Joes. And so when I used to hear those stories about my uncles, it was just that much more, you know, sort of encouraging and that aspect of like, yes, I know this is the path I'm going to go down one day. So from a very young age, I knew I was going to join the military, go through high school, take the ASVAB the junior year, scored pretty well. So the recruiter was pretty keen on, you know, coming and talking to me. So I did the delayed entry program, because I knew that's what I wanted to do. And that's where I wanted to go. So I was, you know, gung ho, ready, you know, what a high speed, low drag. And growing up, this wasn't a great place to live, because a rural town in America, you know, there's a lot of issues with substance abuse and lack of funding to address a lot of issues. So I was really, you know, with the impacts of being in a not so healthy environment, and then also knowing, you know, what I wanted to do, it was very clear, like my path forward was just like, let's go. So I did pretty well on my ASVAB. I placed to do fire control specialists on Patriot missile systems. So I graduated end of May, beginning of June 2001. And then I ended up leaving in July of 2001 for basic training. So, you know, we're going through basic training, and then September 11th happens, which that brought a screeching halt to any sort of secret clearance or background checks, which for that job, you had to have one. And, you know, there was already a backlog at that time. So there, I was in line, but in the back of the line. So they were hoping, you know, once you get through basic, okay, it'll be done. And then you can go to your AIT, which mine was supposed to. I went through basic training in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. So after 9/11, like shut everything down, like the line stopped moving completely. We finished basic training, and at the schoolhouse, they basically just said, look, like either you can switch to another MOS or you can sit in a holdover status and, you know, kind of wait it out and see how this is going to go. And at the time, I was like, really, the way my recruiter sold me that job, like I was really excited to do it. It sounded like a lot of problem solving. So I was like, okay, I'm going to wait it out. So while we were in holdover status, we were still on like the basic training side of the base. So we didn't have any freedom. We couldn't just like go to the PX or, you know, do anything. So in the mornings, we would do PT with the drill sergeants. And then after that, we would go work at CIF, the Central Issuing Facility, which was like one of the coolest times when I was in the military, because I got to see the moment in the movies where you see the drill sergeants just attacking and swarming anybody who wasn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And it was hilarious. It was almost, I think, around 2 months when the folks from the schoolhouse side came and said, look, like, we don't know if this line is even going to start moving and at what pace it's going to move forward. So we don't know how long this is. So we're going to kind of lean on you here, make a decision about what you want to do. And they had a list of MOSs that, you know, we qualified for and were available for us to sort of just transfer over into parallel to where we were and just kind of slide in. Well, they were really pushing hard artillery. And one of my drill sergeants was artillery himself. So I'm like, okay, all right. And, you know, there wouldn't be any more holdover status. They would literally get me that Monday into an AIT that, you know, I could just move it forward and then I'd be done in 9 weeks. And I was like, that sounds real nice. So, you know, I signed up and then moved over to the 2nd of the 80th, which is basic training combined with AIT side of Fort Sill. Yeah, 9 weeks later, I was done and headed to Germany. The best lesson I learned, and it was something that one of my favorite leaders told me, and he said, of all the things in the world that you can be useful. And that always kind of stuck with me because in the military and you know, corporate situations and all different types of social interactions, I always wanted to be the type of person that, you know, people looked at that got stuff done. So I'm at my best when I'm being useful and I have something to motivate me towards either accomplishing or helping with, or, you know, helping someone that makes me feel that, you know, sort of gratification of feeling useful. So out of Germany, I did a 6-month peacekeeping tour in Kosovo. I was in the best shape of my life, I'm pretty sure, when I was there, because there was a lot of time for physical training. So I ran a half marathon while I was there. So that was one of my big life accomplishments. So then after Kosovo, we came back and the orders came down that we were going to be going to Iraq, and they needed a main effort for a task force, meaning they needed an infantry company. So our first sergeant raised his hand and said, I can cross-train these guys to be infantrymen. So, and then we deployed to Iraq for 12 months on a combat mission. Our area of occupation was around a city called Baji in the area near Tikrit, where they call the Triangle of Death. Our platoon specifically was called the IED platoon. So there in that area, the main highway, Highway 1, was in our area of occupation. So we would do, on top of, you know, dismounted patrols and raids and, you know, movements to contact where we were kind of looking for trouble, we would also do convoy security. The reason we got the name IED platoon is because we got hit more often than the other platoons did. And there's no, you know, sort of rhyme or reason. It's just, you know, luck of the draw. You're out there when they're out there. That's all it really is. So when we were in Iraq, like I definitely saw my fair share of combat, numerous firefights in the city, out of the city. I felt a part of that brotherhood of, you know, the trial by fire, and definitely feel like I earned the title of a combat veteran. But when we got back to Germany and they were almost immediately telling us that, you know, it was going to be a quick turnaround and we were going back, I just didn't feel like that was enough time for me to mentally and emotionally prepare for what it would take to go back for another 12 months. And my contract was coming up. I think it was about, we came back in February, so that would have been 5 months later, my contract was finishing. So it was past the point where they were doing any stop losses. They were letting people out. They were letting a lot of people that were stop lost, you know, stuck in the service while we were in Iraq, they were letting them out. So that just kind of all lined up for me where, like, you know, I was, as much as I you know, loved, you know, my brothers, and there was always a little bit of doubt in the back of my mind. Like I just felt it was better for me to come home. So all I really knew was, like, I wanted to go to college. When I was younger, I'd broken my ankle playing basketball. And so I had to go see a podiatrist. And once I got to learning about my foot, I was really interested in feet. And, you know, I always had this idea, well, one day I'd like to be, you know, that guy that helps, you know, people heal their injuries and, you know, help take care of your feet. Cause that's one of the most important parts of your body. Like, we don't realize, like, that's the point at which we contact the earth. So I had an eye on you know, starting at community college and then going on to medical school. But I was not prepared for the weight of the college expectations, how much work it is, how much reading. So the last time I had done it was high school. So it took me some time to kind of get my feet under me as far as school goes. But I was just sure I really wanted an education. Just let's get to associate's degree and, you know, go from there. The most challenging part, once I came home, I didn't expect the boundaries that I encountered around PTSD, depression, and anxiety. You're aware of it because when you're getting out, there is a good amount of communication and counseling around those topics, but you don't know what it's going to feel like. Like when you hit that wall, there are these manifestations of these really heavy feelings that create a literal boundary to you getting to where you're trying to go. And so while I was in college, I had to medically withdraw multiple times because as I was going through the semester, I hit these walls. And at the time, I didn't have the language to even talk about what I was going through, let alone how to get myself out of it. It was just, you know, kind of giving myself the time and space to engage with the feelings, engage with the boundary, where that boundary was, where it started, where it stopped, to try and figure out my own abilities of what I could do, how far I could push myself, and, you know, how far I could put myself out there, even as far as relationships, friendships. And it took, like I said, multiple times where I just had to stop trying so hard and give myself the space and the time to, like, I don't want to say heal, but just figure out what I was feeling and then try and start developing the tools I needed to still keep on moving forward. You know, when I had a panic attack, like, how am I going to deal with this? Like what tools am I going to use? Now I know if I start feeling that panicked, stressful fight or flight response, like I need to take deep breaths. I need to wiggle my toes, which might sound weird, but that's like a way of me grounding myself and like, okay, get out of your head, like be here, be present. I graduated from community college and then started at Arizona State University, got involved with some veteran stuff there, and they invited me to go to the Student Veterans Association's national conference, which was being hosted in Phoenix. So I went to the event and, you know, got some good learning. But one of the days was a service project day with this organization I never heard of called the Mission Continues. I was like, okay, like, you know, go out and do some good stuff. Cool. So we get out there and got to talking to a few of them. And at the time, Ryan Cannon was the platoon leader, and he kind of got to me and started, you know, talking about what the organization did and how it operated and how it was a genuine service organization where there's opportunities to actually put your hands in the community, because a lot of VSOs don't have that, you know, engagement. Like I said, you know, I've always been a person where I feel like I need to be doing something and feeling useful. And when Ryan was talking about this organization, it just sounded like, you know, I could be useful. And that was, at the time, something that, you know, really meant a lot to me because, you know, with all the depression and anxiety and PTSD stuff, like, I just felt really useless and, like, worthless. So the project was in this little area that, you know, had a lot of history to it. You know, the city just didn't have the resources to come in and do some of this, you know, fine-tuning work and detail work. And we came in there. They gave us, you know, the history of the place, which made us kind of feel connected and feel a part, you know, of that place. And then gave us the opportunity to, you know, make it beautiful. And I remember that day seeing it from what it was until what we were done. I remember feeling very impressed by, like, oh, they're not just coming in here and like slapping some paint on a wall. Like there's an organization and forethought to how this operation is going to go on and then coming out and actually executing. So the Phoenix platoon, at this point, I feel like very stacked and really in an advantageous position where Gary is our platoon leader. Then we have Apichai, Carrie, myself, and John, who fill out the other four positions on that leadership team. So we're able to equally distribute the workload that goes into making, you know, the events and the service opportunities available to veterans and people that want to get involved. So I feel real lucky for that. Me specifically, my position is the veterans engagement specialist, which that means I'm trying to engage with the veteran community as a whole to try and get them to come to events, to try and get them involved. And my kind of personal perspective on it, because I have worked with a lot of other veterans organizations in the past and looking for areas that there's overlap or opportunity for that, you know, that mutual benefit, you know, stir up that interest. Because a lot of the times with an organization like ours, who doesn't spend lots of money, you know, out there marketing, are able to clearly see, you know, once they're presented with it, they're like, oh, wow, this is good. This is good stuff right here. So like with our platoon in Phoenix, we focus mainly in the South Phoenix area that have a very strong sense of community, but not a whole lot of support. And when Gary was tasked with finding an organization or a community to support, so happy that he found our partners, which is the Tiger Mountain Foundation, who their main focus is around food security and food sovereignty. So there was a point in my life where I was hopeless and felt worthless and just not good enough. I was homeless and didn't have anything. I still had family and friends and people that cared about me, but I just felt so alone, like in the world. And having to dig myself out of that, I know how hard it is. And I know sometimes just having somebody there just to, you know, give you a bump on the shoulder and say, let's keep going. You know, if I can give that to someone, like my life is complete. Well, with the Phoenix Platoon, I'm definitely excited around our work with, you know, food sovereignty, food security, seeing that communities that don't have the resources are going to be safeguarded against, you know, stressors like, you know, the economy or, you know, climate change. So knowing that I've had that opportunity to have any sort of impact in that area, like, definitely means a lot. Personally, like I found that I have kind of fallen into this niche around sustainable agriculture, both on like a community level, business level, ecosystem level. We have an opportunity with the organization called Reap Goodness and their Heartland Project to create a 1 acre, you know, starting out at least in the beginning, a 1 acre food forest adjacent to this really beautiful outdoor area called the Arboretum here in Superior. So yeah, I'm going to keep moving forward and doing things in agriculture, and veterans leadership is something I mean, obviously being the commander of American Legion, still very passionate about and want to help to keep working in. Giving veterans a genuine like opportunity to go out and get their hands dirty and make them feel as though they're serving their community, I think is a huge part of it. Kind of passing the torch of leadership in a lot of ways and trusting them with like, here you go, you know, take this on and show me what you can do. Because I know when I was, you know, just, you know, 10 years younger than I am now, when I went into a VFW, like I was almost kind of laughed out of the place. Cause like, what do you know? Like, what can you do? And I always remember that kind of like when I first got involved, kind of being like, wait, why do I not deserve that level of respect? Me also being a service member, me also being a combat veteran, like, why don't I get that same level of respect and trust? And I think giving that to some, you know, to younger veterans is going to be a key part of passing the torch of leadership, but also helping to, you know, spread the flames of social change and social justice and really setting something right in our country. Thank you, David. I appreciate it. And Charlie Mike.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We are The Mission Continues. We invest in veterans and under-resourced communities, developing new skill sets and equipping a growing veteran volunteer movement with the tools to drive positive change. To find more resources and to get involved, visit us at missioncontinues.org. See you on the next episode of the Boots on the Ground podcast, presented by The Mission Continues. Charlie Mike, continue the mission.